Thanks, Arun.
Thank you.
No, it's fun to be here. I just happened to be in town over at the Fields giving a talk this morning. For all the machine learners who are here, you're going to be disappointed. It's the same talk, pretty much. So. But for the rest of you, this is actually, it's like a mirror talk. I want to explain to physicists maybe why we've been using machine learning in the last year or 2 years on some kind of outstanding problems in quantum many-body physics. So this is work with Juan Carrasquilla, who is a postdoc at Perimeter. How's my mic, by the way? Can you guys hear me back there? Yeah. If I'm too loud, let me know. So Juan moved to D-Wave now. D-Wave's interested in this idea of quantum machine learning in some sense, which I'll maybe talk about a bit. And I have a couple bright young students who are pioneering a lot of this work at Perimeter Waterloo. Why am I in Toronto today? You know the Gartner hype cycle? I think this is high praise. This is the 2016. If you haven't seen this, expectations versus, I don't know what the axes are, but this is something that, you know, people use in industry to ask whether technology is maybe overhyped, underhyped, has a lot of potential. These, you know, technologies, emerging technologies, there's an innovation trigger, peak of inflated expectations. Yeah, I love that. Trough of disillusionment. I've been down here my whole life. Slope of enlightenment to the plateau of productivity. It's amazing. Look at the peak of this. 2016, machine learning is at the peak of inflated expectations. But actually, if you look a couple years back, I think machine learning was all over on this on this plot. So, you know, machine learning is definitely, I think, piquing the interest and inspiring our imagination. And, you know, Toronto is, like I said, in the Fields Institute, it's the center of the universe in many senses for machine learning. You know, for the physicists who are in the CIFAR programs, maybe quantum materials or quantum information, there's a CIFAR program in machine learning, and I forget what it's called off the top of my head. It's intelligence and machines and brains or something like that, which Jeff Hinton started with Yann LeCun and Benjou in 2004. I think it's not crazy to say that, you know, all of the innovation along the lines of deep learning and so on that's changing our world, you know, coming out of Silicon Valley, started here in that CIFAR program. So it's kind of remarkable in a way. You could say that Toronto changed the world, definitely in that sense. And so maybe for us working in quantum materials, you know, we could be inspired. You know, where's that room temperature superconductor? It's time for us to change the world too. No, really, you know, CIFAR played a huge role, and you could say CIFAR really changed the course of technology in this sense. So it's really amazing. Why do I care? I mean, what's this? Why do we want to use the technology that distinguishes between pictures of cats and dogs to do physics research? So I think just the flavor of this is what I want to kind of get across today. So you might think, okay, well, you know, some of these problems aren't so different. In a physics talk, I would say, you know, if pixels, if you had black and white pixels in an image that had n pixels in it, you know, the state space is somehow exponential. So there's an exponential complexity involved with looking at all the configurations in state space and some stat-mech way of thinking and assigning that label cat or dog or paramagnet or ferromagnet or pneumatic phase or error-correcting regime for a topological qubit or whatever, right? Looking at topological objects like links. These are all very mathematically complex problems. And the goal of machine learning is to somehow learn the general rule that maps, say, all of these pixels, this 2 to the n complex, highly complex state space, into that label. Okay, so it's not crazy to think that we might want to do that with some spin state, assign some label, for example, or some configuration of a wave function in the quantum sense. And what's new about machine learning is the idea that, you know, in my field, we've designed these algorithms for decades. You know, my advisor looked at, you know, quantum Monte Carlo for the Hubbard model. You know, people have designed tensor networks, all sorts of designed algorithms based on physical principles, you know, to solve these highly complex problems. But what machine learning is teaching us is that you can also have algorithms that somehow learn. And what do they learn? Well, they can either learn things like correlations, neutron scattering, STM pictures or scanning electron microscope pictures. You know, they could maybe learn to spot correlations that aren't obvious to the eye. This is kind of maybe an experimental application in some sense, which is, by the way, being used all the time in physics. People at CERN and even people who do high throughput maybe materials and stuff are thinking about machine learning in this context. But I'm also interested in the algorithms themselves. And we, you know, when we don't know the rules to design an algorithm, like a tensor network, we know there's a rule associated with area law, whatever, entanglement. But maybe we don't know what the rule is that we're looking for. And so machine learning, the philosophy is that you don't need to know. You know, the algorithm will learn this if you design the algorithm correctly. So it's more less design, more learning. And specifically, I'm thinking of like, well, what if I have, say, cluster moves in a complex, you know, Ising model, and I want to you sample this in some way, and I don't know how to design global moves. This is my Monte Carlo side speaking. Machines can maybe teach us how to do that. So I actually took these 3 points from machine learning literature, and I just kind of interpret them in my own way. But this is what machine learners think of when they're applying their tools to a problem. So for this audience, what I'm going to do, hopefully, is talk about the simplest kind of paradigm in machine learning that I know of in terms of this classification. And this is called supervised learning. It's when you have data, like these images that I've been showing, and you want to assign a label to maybe new data that's coming in. And so for any of you kids out there that want to learn neural networks and machine learning, the first thing you'll probably do is a supervised learning with a neural network on what's called the MNIST data set. And this is a set of handwritten digits. I think it came from Census Bureau employees or you know, something in the US, high school students, or I can't remember exactly who they made write these numbers. But there's a huge database of these numbers out there. And you know, 70,000 of I think they're roughly 20 by 20 pixels in these images with all these different fives and zeros and nines. And there's labels associated with them. And is it strange to say? The Ising model of machine learning is MNIST. Or the hydrogen atom of machine learning is solving this learning problem. Taking this crazy five and identifying that label with it. And so thinking ahead, it makes sense that that's what we might want to do. Take configurations of a 2D Ising model. This is what I'll start with. This is all spins down except for some defects, all spins up. Paramagnetic phase, some critical region, and just assign the labels associated with that phase. And I'm going to use the same algorithm as machine learners use. Okay? So that's the problem. That's kind of the strategy. And how this is done in the machine learning context is through some function. You define some function that takes this 20 by 20, I guess that's why I have 400 here, and maps it to one of the labels. Okay? And the function, the representation of the function that I'm going to use is called a neural network. So the neural network, I've written a neural network here. I'm going to explain all these pieces, but what it is an object that takes this as input and does some sort of nonlinear mapping to this output. And without getting into details, there's a theorem about universal representation of any continuous function with this type of neural network. So let me just actually skip to this slide, and we'll look at some of the details. So this is called a feed-forward neural network. I'm going to define what all these connections and nodes are. But this is the general structure that I want you to think about. And this is what I'm calling the input layer, because I'm taking that image, that picture of a cat, or that like Ising configuration, and I'm feeding in the values of all the pixels or all the spins, if you will, into this layer here. This is feed-forward because this, through a series of activation functions, gets mapped to labels. So for the MNIST problem, you're feeding in these handwritten digits, 5, 6, 9. And what you want to do is activate what's called an output neuron. Okay, so you want one of these things to fire. Say, you know, that's a number 9, that's a number 2. Okay, that's kind of the goal of this mapping. So this feed-forward neural network, what this all means, all these connections, is what people call weights and biases. So the X's are my input, like X One could just be one for a spin up, or zero for a spin down, or it could be a grayscale, you know, anything between zero and one. There's different ways of thinking about this input vector. There's a weight, and for each neuron, so each one of these circles, which occurred here in the neural network, we assign also a bias. So the weight is Wij, and the bias is B, associated with that neuron I. And the J is the index on the input vector. So each one of those circles is what's called an activation function. And there's different forms that the machine learners use for these activation functions. But this is a standard one called a sigmoid neuron. I'm going to come back to why this is important. And this is a functional form where Z is just this argument here. So weights and biases. So each neuron is either activated, which means its output is either is 1, or not activated with this continuous function according to the input and all the weights and biases. Okay? And if you're wondering why is this the function? There's many functions that people use in machine learning literature. Early on, people use this kind of step function called a perceptron. Love that name. You know, a hyperbolic tangent. What people have shown is that actually learning could be more efficient with what's called a rectified linear unit. So, you know, by trial and error, people have designed these neural network activation functions to work in some sense that I'm going to talk about. So let's just keep this sigmoid in mind. What is learning? Learning is using data, like a bunch of data that you have stored somewhere, to assign weights and biases. So weights are, again, weights are these lines, and biases are like individual, fields or biases on each node. So that's what learning means. You can already start to see that some sort of maybe optimization problem. You're trying to find the best set of weights and biases to define this feed-forward function that assigns digits, 6, to the label, right? So what MNIST is, if you go online and you do a machine learning tutorial, MNIST is this data set of 70,000 images is typically split into two different categories. A set of images for training and a set of images for what I'm going to call testing, which is where you check the machine to make sure that it's doing what you want. Training is the process, again, or maybe training or learning are the same thing. It's the process of assigning the weights and biases. Okay, so I actually think, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, but I think the test images were handwritten by different people than the training images. So the idea with machine learning is you want to be able to generalize things. You know, you build a machine, it learns how to recognize a cat, and then you want to feed it pictures of a Siamese cat or something, some cat it's never seen before, right? So that idea of generalization is, I think, one of the founding, or sort of the foundational paradigms of machine learning. Okay, so how do we do the learning? How do we assign the weights and biases? So you do it through a cost function. So these supervised learning problems, there's a label that you a priori know for the training set. Okay, 6 is a 6. So when I didn't draw the whole neural network, but when I feed in an input vector of all these pixels, I know the label. Given that input vector, I know what the label should be. And here's the actual label, A. So you can just define any cost function, mean squared error. What's this one called? Cross entropy. This is one lots of people use. And what these cost functions do is sort of define the landscape for learning, the optimization landscape that in physics we're used to, this like a free energy landscape. We're trying to sink to the bottom of this thing to somehow optimize or train the network in the best way possible, given its configuration, to minimize that cost. Okay, and so when the labels are the same, if you get the same label that you expect 100% of the time, then you've maybe perfectly trained your neural network. So that's what training is. There's parameters in all of this stuff. So the parameters that are the weights and biases are what you're trying to learn. But when you look at this thing, you also see, well, there's stuff like the number of hidden units in the middle, right? These neurons, this layer of neurons here, I didn't specify what size this is. This is fixed by the input. This is fixed by the output. That's what people call a hyperparameter. So there's all sorts of hyperparameters that go into this cost function. And the parameters are updated to minimize the cost function subject to different types of hyperparameters. Another hyperparameter is the learning rate in the gradient descent. So how do you do this optimization? Calculate the gradient. I think for physicists, this is fairly straightforward to conceptualize. You have weights and biases. That's your parameters. You want to update your parameters based on the gradient or the cost function. And gradient descent is has a free parameter that is called a learning rate to the machine learners. So you have number of hidden neurons. You have a learning rate. These are two hyperparameters that we've already encountered. So, that might seem like a detail. The training of the neural network or the optimization for us, that might seem like a detail, but that is really the devil in the detail for machine learners. So I think one of the big breakthroughs that happened in the last, say, 5 or 10 years, which made machine learning explode all over onto the AI scene and into technology and IT, is the fact that people have understood maybe heuristic algorithms that are efficient in training. Okay, so the actual act of optimizing and finding that at least maybe local minimum to that optimization function. And some of these breakthroughs, of course, many of them came out of Toronto, were maybe in retrospect, understandable, but at the time, I think, weren't all that clear. So one of them is computing the full gradient. It seems like compute the gradient, why not? Well, it turns out to be maybe exponentially hard or actually a very difficult computational problem. So one of the first things people realized in machine learning was that you replace the slow calculation of the gradient. X is the input, the number of input vectors, right? So if you have a single X that defines one, instance of your cost, but you have to somehow sum this over all, NX is the number of elements in your training set, like 60,000 digits, say. That's a costly computation. So people actually just choose a random number, M, maybe 10 or 20, and calculate approximately the gradient and hope that, on average, that's the same as the true gradient. It's called a stochastic gradient descent. You want to turn that cost function into something that tells you how to update parameters, weights, and biases. So you need partial derivatives back through the network. You go from the output, you step back to the hidden layer. If it's deep, you have many hidden layers. That's called backpropagation. It's application of the chain rule for us, but again, applying the chain rule to the training of parameters through the cost function was another big breakthrough in machine learning that started back in the 80s. And again, I've been talking about hyperparameters. Like I say, the art and the state of the art, what many machine learners do is think about hyperparameters. How big is this M? That's called a mini batch. Number of epochs, if you've heard this word. How many times you go through the whole training set? M, how many times you go through the full NX? The learning rate, the number of hidden units, and something I'm not really talking about, the regularization to somehow prevent overfitting. That's the bane of machine learning, is overfitting this function so that it's not generalizable. Okay. And if you do all this stuff, you get very accurate feed-forward neural networks for some of these classification problems. You can do it yourself. There's software packages. This is how I learned how to do it. You just download TensorFlow from Google, go on some tutorial, start building these neural networks. You can get MNIST, this data set, very easily off the internet. And you can look at least a list of the best performers in MNIST classification. And I think Jeff Hinton has the world record. 0.21% error in I think this, I want to say this is a convolution neural network, although I'm not 100% sure. So 2013, basically this record hasn't been broken. Keep in mind, you say, well, it's not perfect, 0.21%. Look at some of these digits. Yeah. I don't know what was going on in the Census Bureau with that. Must have been a Friday. Yeah. Yeah. No. There's other data sets out there that MNIST is like the standard one. So. Okay, forget MNIST. Whoa. Forget. Now let's talk about physics. Let's just take that. Take that exact same technology and forget the handwritten digits. Let's make perfect samples of, say, an Ising model. This is what Juan Carrasquilla did. And he said, let's take this and take the same technology and turn it into a classifier for the different phases that exist in the Ising model. And so if you study StatMech, you might know that the ground state of this classical Hamiltonian at low temperatures, if this is positive, if J is positive, is one where all spins want to align. And at high temperatures, it's completely random. Spins don't care what their neighbors are doing. This means nearest neighbors, right? We call these two phases ferromagnet and paramagnet. So I can use the same feed-forward neural network to classify, say, images or configurations of an Ising model. I'm just going to produce these images with my usual Monte Carlo program. So it's just a black box that produces images, two-dimensional configurations. And I'm going to train and test, the neural network. And so one thing I just want to mention is that if you just trained at zero temperature, like a perfect ferromagnet with no thermal defects in it, you kind of defeat the purpose of maybe machine learning in the sense that it wouldn't be very generalizable. If you started getting thermal defects, you might misclassify or something like that. So what Quan did was, he took a range of temperatures. If you don't know, there's an actual phase transition in two dimensions between the paramagnet and the ferromagnet. That's Onsager's temperature, or Onsager's transition. And he took a range of temperatures above and below and labeled these down here ferromagnet. Maybe did 10,000 at five different temperatures and 10,000 at five temperatures above TC. And he just trained the neural network with that labeled data set. And this is the output on a test set. Again, the test set is a different set in principle. And it doesn't even have to be at the same temperatures. Here I had five above, five below. Here we produce the test set with, dozens of temperatures above and dozens of temperatures below TC. And we asked that trained, feed-forward, completely standard neural network to classify the configurations as they came out of the black box. And so this is the output. I have different system sizes, L by L. And this is the output neuron associated with the ferromagnet, colored in blue. And this is the output of the other output neuron, which I've labeled red for the paramagnet. And see, it's activated, or it's one, above the thermodynamic transition, which is this line. And it shuts off, and the other neuron turns on. Okay. So as you increase system size, you see that you're basically getting a more and more accurate view of where the phase transition is. Even if you haven't specifically trained in that region, you're getting a more and more accurate picture of the phase transition. For the physicists, which is all of us, I guess, I think what's interesting about this is you can turn the output of the neural network into, it's not an estimator, but you can average over it. It's not an estimator in the traditional sense of StatMech or, say, if you're doing Monte Carlo or something like that. But if you average over the output for the test set, then you can do things like finite size scaling. Okay, so here's 1 over L. So here's different. This is 50%. If you look at where these things cross 50%, it means they're just randomly classifying whatever comes in there. So if you look at that 50% point as a function of 1 over L, you basically get within error bars, for some reasonable training, the correct estimate of the thermodynamic transition. That's cool, but what I think is really cool is if you do a proper finite size scaling collapse, this is T minus TC, L to the 1 over nu, then you can calculate nu. So you can calculate the critical exponent for the divergence of the correlation length from the output of a feed-forward neural network that was originally trained for MNIST. So, oh, I think it's cool. Whatever. So the other thing I always emphasize when people immediately say, okay, this is a really easy problem. You're classifying, you have two outputs. One of them is basically ordered. One of them is disordered. Yeah, and I think that's the point. You start with a model like this that you fully understand. What that lets us do, or what I let Juan do, is construct a toy model for the feed-forward neural network. So here's the hidden units, and he only needed three. One that I'm going to call all spins up, all spins down, and up or zero. You can't see that. This is an analytical model. There's no training. But if you write the weights, this is n by 3, the biases for those three neurons, then the argument of that activation function, or the activation functions, up to some free parameter you can show is the magnetization, plus, minus, or plus, plus epsilon, which gives you these functions. This is the magnetization. So what you're learning is the magnetization. No surprise, right? But this model, this type of modeling of neural networks lets you show that. The output, again, these two output neurons, there's no biases needed, give you the essentially this same graph. You know, they give you the toy model will give you the same finite size scaling and everything on the test set. It's cool. It's generalizable. If you train something on a square lattice, for example, you could take that trained neural network and feed it raw configurations coming from a black box from a different lattice, which it may have a different transition temperature, but you'll correctly detect that transition temperature. And from a physics point of view, it makes sense. If you have a machine that's learned the magnetization, then that's the order parameter, right? So you'll see the order parameter turn on at the right point. And it also works for different ordering wave vectors, up to some caveats. You have to be a little bit careful, but anti-ferromagnets, things in Q space. In principle, the sky's the limit in terms of classifying different ordering wave vectors. What I want to do is show something a little more exotic. A model without a ground state order parameter. So if you don't have the equivalent of the magnetization or some other fancy wave vector, if you don't have order, then what does a neural network see? So one of these models called Square Ice, which I like, just is a Hamiltonian that allows in its ground state only 6 different vertices. Now the degrees of freedom are on the bonds. It's a 6 vertex model. Your model's disordered. There's an extensive degeneracy. Has algebraic decay of correlations. But there's no order parameter. Every vertex in the ground state just has one of these 6, but there's no other constraints. So let me take that same neural network and train it at 2 temperatures, 0, where these constraints hold, and infinite, where it's just completely random. So here's a snapshot of an infinite, the degrees of freedom are on bonds, so it's kind of decorated lattice. Each one of these spins is 50-50, black or white. Here's the ground state of that constrained, whatever Hamiltonian, that's square ice. I don't know. Actually, I can't see the difference. But the neural network can see the difference essentially 100% of the time. So you just feed in these configurations, you train the neural network, you send it in a test set, it can, and you just, whatever labels you want, there's just 2 outputs, it'll essentially 100% of the time, or Juan's very precise, it's only 99%, it'll correctly classify the constrained emergent electrodynamics from some completely random thing. And that's kind of amazing because even when I show you these pictures, I bias things because I've given you the dimension and I've given you the locality. And in the feed-forward neural network, you just kind of strip all that away and feed in one-D vector, completely arbitrary. So the feed-forward neural networks, which are fully connected, they have no a priori knowledge of locality. Okay. And so that turns out to bite you in the screw. It screws you in a different model, which is a model of, it's a classical model of a topological qubit in some sense. It's I would call it a Z2 gauge theory, an Ising gauge theory. Some other Hamiltonian, degrees of freedom on the bonds. In the ground state, it admits 8 plaquettes instead of 6 vertices. It's just slightly different. There's 8. Maybe that's the only difference. There's no other constraints. It's 0 temperature. It has a ground state degeneracy. The correlation function decays exponentially, but let's do the same classification. Which one's which? I can tell the difference here. So that's the ground state of the Z2 gauge theory. That has all these constraints, 8 plaquettes. This one has no constraints. It's just completely random, up and down, 50% of the time. I don't know, for my mind, that's easier to classify, but the neural network cannot distinguish those 2 things. It doesn't matter what we do. The feed-forward neural network cannot see the difference between this and this. Isn't that crazy? It doesn't matter how we train the thing. It just doesn't work. So it's very interesting. It's like, what's different between those 2 problems? One's a 6-vertex model. One's an 8-vertex model. I mean, the correlations decay differently. And somehow this affects the learning or the learnability of the neural network. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. So just a note, you can fix it. You need to take the technology that Jeff Hinton developed, I don't know, years ago, which kind of restores, I believe, the concept of locality to the data set. So a convolutional neural network does that. This is less general. It's not a fully connected thing without locality. I'm not going to explain it, but a convolutional neural network takes filter maps, which is basically takes a convolution on a finite size, 2x2, which gives you the idea of locality, or gives the network the a priori condition of locality. This is how images are processed in reality. Produces this filter layer, and then through some slightly more sophisticated neural network can do a proper classification. So, you know, just like in real imaging or image processing or computer vision, the same technology that's used for state-of-the-art, you know, computer vision and classification fixes the problem with the Z2 gauge theory. And I believe it does so basically because it puts locality back in. So it's kind of fun, you know, our problems, they're fully characterized in StatMech. You know, we fully understand in some sense how correlations and locality and order correlation functions play roles. And we can start mapping these into pre-existing or, you know, existing machine learning technology to see how they behave. I think that's one of the neat things about this area of research. Oh, yeah, I won't mention that. That's fun, too. But so my group's been using supervised learning. You can even do it in quantum systems. If you have quantum Monte Carlo that produces a D plus one dimensional configuration, that's your image. You might have a three-dimensional image for a two-dimensional physical system. But, you know, just like classical Monte Carlo, you have a Markov chain, you're producing configurations, and you're replacing the estimator, you know, very importantly, with the output of the neural network. And so this has maybe implications for models with the sign problem, things that, you know, if you have an estimator, you have a variance, a large variance that comes from averaging a sign. You know, maybe this is one way to kind of classify phases and sign problematic regions of Hamiltonians. But that's all wild speculation. Let's go back to cats. So, supervised learning, assigning labels. What if I don't want to assign a label? What if I want to produce a picture of a cat? Okay, so that's a different problem. And this is, a picture of a cat that's been produced by some machine. I don't know, it's hideous. But, so let's change gears. I want to produce the cat. Forget classifying a cat. How do I do this? Well, this is a general strategy. Let me take my neural network. So my cat is just this vector of x. And I've drawn this vector from some unknown probability distribution. Whatever that probability distribution of a cat is what gave you that image. For us, for the Ising model, spin, I guess S means spin, there's a physical probability distribution that's the Boltzmann distribution, right? So what we're doing is we're drawing samples from the Boltzmann distribution. So if I can run my neural network backwards after it's trained and have it produce configurations according to this distribution, then I'm basically producing that image of a cat for whatever my physical problem is. And it makes sense that you can maybe use a neural network, but you can't have this output layer. You've got to cut this output layer off. So the model is you might have visible physical units. That's your spins that would occur in this physical Hamiltonian. Then you have hidden units. And at some point, you want to produce a probability distribution. And if you're a physicist, you might start thinking of a wave function or probability density from a wave function or psi squared. So you can start thinking, what I'm trying to do here is represent a wave function. And I'm trying to do it in some efficient way on a classical computer using some kind of neural network that I've cut off the output layer. So that's Jeff Hinton's restricted Boltzmann machine. This is a very highly successful paradigm in machine learning. So what's a restricted Boltzmann machine? I would say it's a type of Ising model in some sense. You have these are no longer activation functions. That's different than the feed-forward neural network. These are also just variables, random variables between 0 or 1. So you have an input vector, which is 0 or 1 or minus 1, plus 1, however you want to do it. And then you have a hidden layer that is also, you know, zeros and ones. And you have parameters, weights again. And now you have biases that are both present on the the physical and the hidden units. And I'll explain what that with this model is in a minute. And so what this thing is a machine that will produce a probability distribution, a joint distribution, between the visible and hidden units. And these connections are important in a way that I'll talk about soon. Machine learners call these energetic models, and it's because there's a Hamiltonian. That's a Hamiltonian. The weights are the Ising connections between visible and hidden units. The B's and C's, these are just the fields associated with magnetic fields associated with the units. And those are the parameters that you want to train. You got to train all that set of parameters that I've called lambda in order to produce this distribution. So there's a big literature on this that you can check out. One point is, in terms of representation, I'll just say now, is that given enough hidden units, it's theoretically known that you can tune the machine to give you any distribution. And the distribution you want is what's called a marginal distribution, which I would say is distribution where you've traced out the hidden units, right? So you've traced out the hidden units and have some other functional, which machine learners call the free energy, but I don't know what I would call that. I just call it F, I guess. So if you trace out the hidden units, you have a model for your physical distribution, and I mean, I think it's just a mathematical fact that with enough hidden units, you can represent any distribution. So in terms of this concept of, or this idea that this is a wave function and you're storing the wave function, the idea of storing it efficiently on a classical computer is basically saying that you have a polynomial number of hidden units. It depends polynomially on the number of input spins or something like that. Okay, so for physics, maybe the fact that you can represent any distribution isn't interesting unless it's in polynomial resources. I would say that's a definition of efficiency for classical computers. Okay, so the goal again is to train the RBM, the restricted Boltzmann machine, so that this marginal distribution is very close to the target. Okay, and then I'm going to sample configurations. So just a note on that, how do we do this? There's no cost function anymore associated with the labels. So people use a cost function defined by the KL divergence, which is, I think, also equal to what's called the relative entropy. I think that's right. So it's a relative entropy. It's basically measuring the distance between these two probability distributions. You define a gradient descent algorithm. Here's a 1D Ising model. You look at how, as a function of training steps, you're minimizing or you're converging to a distribution. You can read all about it. Let's imagine that we've been successful in training. So what's cool about a restricted Boltzmann machine is there's a very specific type of sampling that's possible on the restricted Boltzmann machine. It's called Bloch-Gibbs sampling. So the fact that this is your model, this is your Hamiltonian, there's no connections between the physical spins anymore. Unlike the original Ising model, which is just some black box. Every spin interaction is mediated through the hidden layer. So, and it's fully connected between visible and hidden. So that allows you to calculate analytically the conditional probabilities. So if I have a set of spin states here, I know, what's the probability that xi is equal to 1? It's this. And conversely, what, given this hidden or this visible layer, what's the probability that a spin is up or 1 or 0 in the hidden layer? So what you do once these RBMs are trained, you do something called Bloch-Gibbs sampling, which means alternating between hidden and visible and sampling the spin state. So every second sampling step, you get a contribution to the probability distribution that you're targeting. And what's kind of neat is that if you do this analytically for that energetic Hamiltonian or that E that I showed, you get the sigmoid functions. So the sigmoid functions, which were the activation functions of the feed-forward neural network, are now the firing rate of the stochastic neurons in the restricted Boltzmann machine. I think that's interesting too. We can talk about that later if you wonder what the hell I'm talking about. But so somehow the role of the activation function changes when you move to these generative models, these RBMs. Okay, yeah, enough theory of RBMs. So you can use the Bolson machine once trained to sample, you know, again, this marginal distribution, P of lambda. And you can, in this case, calculate essentially real estimators. Estimators in the same way that you calculate an estimator for a Markov chain Monte Carlo. Block Gibbs sampling is just another type of Markov chain Monte Carlo. You're just going back and forth in a very specific way because you know these conditional probabilities. So in this case, you basically, every time you sample the visible unit, that's just one of, you know, one over number of Block Gibbs samples. You're just calculating an estimator in a conventional way. Energy, magnetization, specific heat, susceptibility, whatever you want, you can calculate from the Bolson machine. So here's some examples. Energy, magnetization, this is my favorite, specific heat. So the black is the exact value for the specific heat that I calculate from the black box. So given a fixed system size, this is the specific heat. When I train the Bolson machine, even though I converge the KL divergence, if I don't have enough hidden units, here's 4 hidden units, here's 16, here's 64. You know, it takes a large number of hidden units to converge, especially near the transition. Out here in the paramagnet, no problem. Out here in the paramagnet, no problem. You know this. If you're deep in the paramagnet or ferromagnetic phase, we have analytical models that say you only need 3 hidden neurons. So somehow you see that it's more difficult to train the machine at the phase transition. And for a physicist, I think this is very interesting. So as you know, the phase transition has a divergent correlation length. Don't judge me on it. This was for the machine learners. I just grabbed this from my talk this morning, so don't judge me. But you know, I wanted to say that, you know, the theory of phase transition, feature extraction from phase transitions is perfectly, I think, you know, epitomized in the renormalization group. So you take your UV physics, you take all your spins in the visible layer, and you do successive coarse grainings until you get, you know, the relationship of the phase to some parameters in a field theory. Maybe that's one way of thinking about it. So you've compressed all the information of the UV or the configurations into just 1 or 2 parameters of a 5-4 theory. Is that crazy? Maybe. You know, there's been exact mapping specifically between the variational RG and deep learning architectures that are exactly what I'm talking about, Bolson machines, but you've stacked the Bolson machines. So I think there's already this folklore out there that, you know, why do you need deep learning? You need deep learning, you need stacked RBMs, that's what deep learning is. You know, because natural phenomena, like pictures of cats, are somehow in some way of looking at it close to a phase transition. And you need some sort of RG type, you know, a separation of, you know, coarse graining of length scales in order to fully or efficiently represent natural images and stuff like that. So it's kind of just an interesting and provocative connection, I think, between physics and some of this deep learning stuff that's coming out. But the idea of efficient representation, I think, is one of the most interesting and maybe fundamental questions that's coming out of machine learning research. So for example, you know, particularly when you go to the quantum case, you know, which quantum wave functions can be efficiently represented on classical computers? You know, we think we understand this in some algorithmic sense. Tensor networks, actually Miles Studemeyer, my friend, wrote a blog post for, you know, explaining tensor networks to machine learning people. So I recommend this highly. Tensor networks are this idea that you take the exponential, you know, number of parameters used to describe a wave function, and you boil it down to something polynomial in N and in the bond dimension or something like that. And these representations only work in certain cases, maybe lower dimensions or low entanglement, like area law entanglement. So we think we know how to connect physics to maybe this idea of efficient representation. But what Bolson machines and neural networks are showing us is there's evidence that some of these deep neural networks or some of these Bolson machines with fully connected hidden and visible units can give us possibly efficient, but maybe not efficient in a scaling way, but possibly efficient representations of some quantum wave functions. And in the last month, you know, the equivalence of RBMs and tensor networks, efficient representation of many body states of neural networks, serious people are giving serious thought to the idea that restricted Boltzmann machines might compete with this tensor network paradigm, at least in some level. And I would put the caveat that, you know, if it's not efficiency in scaling, there could be efficiency gains in the prefactors of scaling that might be good enough for some applications. In the sense of quantum mechanical representation, okay, people are demonstrating, or people are trying to demonstrate this with, the nice thing about neural networks is you can just code them up, feed them configurations. Like, if you have a transverse filializing model, feed it the wave function in the SZ basis. You know, increase the number of hidden units in the machine until you reproduce the physical observables. Why not? Once you've done that, you have a classical representation of that quantum Hamiltonian. You've learned. It's the inverse problem. You basically have samples of a wave function in some basis. You can learn the Hamiltonian, that energetic model. You can learn a classical equivalent. And you don't have to guess. You know, you don't have to guess what's important in decimating the Hilbert space or something like that. You can just let the machine do it for you. So this works. This works very well for... This is something we're doing with Matthias Troyer's people. But here's a paper you should all read. So my friend Giuseppe Carleo and Matthias Troyer, this just came out in Science like maybe a couple weeks ago. The big problem with what I've said for the quantum physicists is, you know, the wave function, well, it's complex, right? It has an amplitude and a phase. So you can't capture that 100% of the time in a classical Boltzmann machine. But if you make the weights complex, and then what Giuseppe did was train a Boltzmann machine with what's called reinforcement learning for the experts, which for us is a type of variational Monte Carlo. So if you make the variational onsets a restricted Boltzmann machine with complex weights, then they can get very good results for, say, this is the error in some energy. I think this is the 2D Heisenberg model. I think it's square lattice. There's no sign problem. So here's the best PEPS variational energy. And this parameter is the number of hidden units over the number of physical spins. And you can see that they've obtained better variational energies from a VMC with a wave function onsets that's basically a complex restricted Boltzmann machine. And even if that's not an improvement in scaling in some Hamiltonian complexity sense, I think that's a pretty remarkable thing. Okay, so I'm done. RBMs can store, this is some old conclusions, can store compact representations of configuration. That's how I thought maybe this was first interesting. I have a Monte Carlo. I'm calculating estimators. I'm always throwing them away. I'm always throwing away the configurations. Why not train the RBM so I can come back later and sample things from the RBM, things I forgot? I don't know. But I don't know if I'll ever use it like that. Where we have used it is sometimes you have problems that are difficult to sample with conventional Monte Carlo. So some of these error-correcting regimes of Z2 gauge theories, where you want to calculate the threshold between, the hardware fault-tolerant threshold for a toric code, those can be hard to sample. So you can train an RBM, a restricted Boltzmann machine, sample that, and do things like threshold detection. So we call these neural decoders. That's a whole other talk. That's a fun application. Because a restricted Boltzmann machine is fully connected and you're learning connections between local or non-local parts of the system, you can use the Boltzmann machines inside of a conventional Monte Carlo to suggest cluster updates. And I think there's a paper like a day or two ago, but I haven't updated my slides, that show explicitly that you can learn cluster updates for highly non-trivial problems in Monte Carlo. So, the field's wide open. Very few people are actually working on this, but I think it's really fun, and there's lots of room and lots of low-hanging fruit. RBMs, can we solve this inverse problem in some efficient way, for all classical or quantum wave functions? Or what's the corner of Hilbert space where we can get efficient representations with Boltzmann machines? Are quantum Boltzmann machines useful? This slide I made before, the Giuseppe Carleo paper, but you can also have Boltzmann machines that have transverse fields as parameters that you're training. This is something that D-Wave is very interested in, because D-Wave wants to be a Boltzmann machine, quantum Boltzmann machine, the quantum transverse field parameters that are trained as part of its annealing. You'll see a lot of this coming out in the future as people looking at algorithms and training algorithms and representation problems for D-Wave-like hardware. I think it's very natural. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting things is there any relationship between deep learning and the RG? I mean, there's papers are coming out all the time on this stuff. This is an interesting kind of overview that, you know, I think physicists and machine learners, they once you learn each other's language, there's lots of things to talk about. And so I guess that's my point. Thank you for your attention. So you know, this idea of transfer learning, you can always train a supervised machine to detect a ferromagnet, or you know, if you work a little harder, I don't know, some other ordering wave vector or a topological phasor. You know, I think the point is if you can train a general machine that giving a given input in a certain, you know, if you correctly give it the right input, it'll just tell you, bang, this output fires. And even though you know nothing about, like, say it's an experiment, neutron scattering. You have all this Q space information, right? Maybe you're looking for ordering wave vectors. Like, that's completely easy to envision, just throwing into these machines that have been trained. And you can train the machines with simulations, which is nice, right? So I think that's an obvious application. I think people doing, like, high-throughput materials science are already thinking about this. You have measurements, whatever, microscope images, blah, blah, blah. You can do more high throughput materials discovery if you can train machines to recognize images that come from certain phases. Cold atoms, you know, these images in these microscopes, another obvious, I think, case. So I think there's lots of room for application there. Out of my field, yeah, I don't know. It's like a general question of whether AI will solve our government problems. I don't know. Sorry. Yeah, it's a good question. There's a lot of machine learning literature on that problem. Like, how do you generalize that so you don't have to have the five centered? You know, what if you have translational symmetry somehow? Yeah, so I think the convolution neural networks are the practical solution of that problem, because you take a small group of local pixels and you apply all these convolution filters to it, and it recognizes different, you know, orientations of features, and then those are extracted into successive layers of, that's what's deep about them. So if you have a deep convolutional network, it'll solve that problem, basically. So people have studied this a lot, and my examples were like too simple, but that's definitely what machine learners do, I think, solve those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think if you take the deep machines and you look at the hidden units, which means you look at all the weights, like for every neuron you look at all the weights and there's n of them, you'll see like a curve. Like, so for a zero, you'll see a top, then another neuron will have the bottom, and the top of the zero might also be used in the top of the nine. So one neuron can be used for like one feature that occurs more than once in these images. And I didn't crack open the neurons, but people do that all the time, and that's basically what it does. It extracts sort of local features first, like local curves and lines and shapes. And then in the deep networks, usually the next layer kind of assembles these into eights and nines and stuff like that. So that's one of the reasons they use these deep networks, is because there's like a hierarchy of features, local and then less local as you go up. Right. Well, so sometimes, like a neuron is trained to detect a feature, I don't know, a whisker or something, but maybe that feature is not so important, and so the bias just devalues that specific neuron.
How is that different than weights?
Weights connect, you know, an input with that neuron. So the biases are just local to the neuron. You can just tune the importance of the neuron up or down. But the weights are the input, you know, how much that pixel is important for that feature.
Okay, maybe one last question. Two questions. Yes. Presumably, this language also talks to computational fluidity. And then the other question is, you know, you talk about CNNs and locality. What this whole system...
Recurrent neural networks? Good question. Don't know the answer to the recurrent. I almost got away, you know, answering all the questions. So I don't know the answer for recurrent neural networks. I haven't used them yet. All my students keep telling me they're useful. Am I being recorded? If you're watching, get on that. I think the point is there's some history dependence there, right, with the recurrence. So you know, you have this recurrence and you remember some part of the past. So I think dynamical properties is the obvious case, right? But I haven't seen specifically, I mean, that might be a wide open problem, you know, using RNNs for dynamical properties. Fluid dynamics, you know, I wish I knew, but I don't know if people have applied this or not. Sorry.
So, no further questions.
Thank you.